idea. We're now doing the ideas of Tchiyas HaMeisim in HaTorah. Like the Mishnah says, if a person, even if he believes in Tchiyas HaMeisim, but if he doesn't believe it is in the Torah, that is enough to disqualify him from Olam Haba. And so now we're discussing what is our makor, what is our source for Tchiyas HaMeisim in HaTorah. So far, we only gave one limud, and that limud is Rav Yochanan. And that is because it says by the giving of Truma, you shall give the Truma to Aaron the Kohen. Now what does that mean? You don't give Truma until you come to the land of Israel. Aaron never came to the Eretz Israel. Aaron died in the Midbar. So the only possible interpretation is there will come a time in which Aaron will have Tchiyas HaMeisim, and then he'll be in Eretz Israel, then he'll get Truma. So this is an illusion, right? This is a source for Tchiyas HaMeisim min HaTorah. Okay. Now we then, Derech Agav, as the Gemara often does, once it gave you one drasha of that pasuk, it gives you other drushes from that same pasuk that are not relevant to the Mishnah. The only relevance to the Mishnah is Tchiyas HaMeisim in HaTorah. But since the pasuk says, V'nasatem mimenu es trumas Hashem li'aron uvanav, you shall give the truma to Aaron and his children, so we have what is called a hekesh. A hekesh is a juxtaposition between Aaron and his children, descendants in other words, and that is just as Aaron was a chaver, his children, his descendants must be chaverim. Now what does chaver mean? Chaver does not mean a friend, but rather chaver, well, in English we would translate it as a colleague. A chaver is the opposite of Am Ha'aretz. Am Ha'aretz in the time of Chazal was a person who was not meticulous in the laws of Tuma Vatara. In other words, he didn't care if he was Tameh or the Truma got Tameh. So we learn out, a chaver is the opposite. A chaver is a person who is meticulous in the laws of Tuma Vatara. So we learn out that just like Aaron was obviously meticulous because he was tzaddik, so too, the only descendants to whom you're allowed to give truma are descendants who are chaverim. In other words, you're not allowed, I am not allowed to give truma to a kohen that's an Am Ha'aretz. Now, I might have thought, well, listen, I'm separating truma. I'm giving it to somebody. Well, what he does with it is his avera. I have no responsibility. Terah says, no, you are not allowed to give truma to a person who will not take the proper respect and the proper steps in treating the truma in accordance with its level of holiness. And how do we know? This is a halacha. You do not give truma to a kohen that's an Am Ha'aretz, because the kohen that gets truma has to be like Aaron. Aaron uvanav, ma Aaron chaver, af banav chaverim. Of course, the question you'll ask is, so how is the poor Kohen Am Ha'aretz supposed to get supported? He's not allowed to get Truma. Well, number one, he will get Truma from Am Ha'aretzim, because they're not going to keep this halacha. Right? It's really, you're really telling a chaver not to get Truma to an Am Ha'aretzim. Number two, he always has the ability not to be an Am Ha'aretz, that's all. In other words, an Am Ha'aretz doesn't have to remain an Am Ha'aretz. In fact, let me emphasize that you don't have to be learned. See, it's different. The meaning of Am Ha'aretz does not mean ignorance. Theoretically, you could be ignorant and still be a chaver. A chaver meant you were meticulous in the laws of Tumah V'Torah. So even if you didn't know how to learn Gemara, whatever it would be, so we might call that person Am Ha'aretz today in modern speech, but that's not the definition of Am Ha'aretz. Am Ha'aretz is a narrowly defined definition. Okay. And now Rav Yochanan gives. So according to Rav Yochanan, how do we know that you don't give truma to an Am Ha'aretz? Because it says Aaron uvanav. We compare Aaron or banav to Aaron. So Derech Agav, the Gemara quotes Rav Yaina's son. Okay, this is really not so much our mission anymore. Who gives another source? Minayin she'ein naistam truma l'kohen Am Ha'aretz. We have another source that you don't give truma. You are not allowed to give truma to a kohen Am Ha'aretz. Shenemar, it says in Divrei Hayamim, Vayomer Liom, Liyoshve Yerushalayim, Lases Menas Kohanim Valavim, Leman Yechesku B'Torah Hashem. That one of the righteous kings of Israel instructed the people who lived in Yerushalayim to give the portions to the Kohanim, which is Truma, and to the Levim, which is Maser, for the in order to strengthen them in their fulfillment of the Torah of Hashem. So what do you see from that pasuk? That the purpose of giving the Truma and the Maser is in order that they should be strengthened in keeping Hashem's Torah. Therefore, Rabbi Yonasan argues, I only give the Truma and the Maser to that person who's going to be meticulous in keeping Hashem's mitzvos and not the Am Haaretz. Kol hamachzik b'Torah Hashem, yesh lo manas, she'eino machzik b'Torah Hashem, ein lo manas. Okay. Again, the Gemara goes on and says, following Amar Rav Acha Bar Adda, this is kind of a side point, but it says, Amar Rav Yehuda, kol hanosein truma l'kohen Am Haaretz, if you give your truma to a kohen that's an Am Haaretz, ki'ilu nasno l'fnei ari, it is as if you fed it to a lion. A strange comparison. Giving truma to an Am Haaretz is like feeding truma to a lion. What does that mean? Why is it compared to a lion? Ma'ari, when you put food in front of a lion, safek, dores, viochel, safek, eino dores, viochel. Okay, dores is when an animal of prey, like a hunter, dores, it puts its paw down and the animal down as it eats it. Right? We ever saw a picture of a lion or a tiger when it attacks a sheep. So it pins the sheep down with its front leg, and then uses the other leg to scrape out the meat. So a lion will be dores, it'll attack with its claw and eat, or maybe it won't do it. Maybe it'll just... What does Rashi say? What do you mean it won't do it? Rashi says, it's dores when it wants to eat right away, or maybe it'll just kill the animal and let it spoil. Right? So dores is when it wants to eat right now, and otherwise it'll just kill it and let it lie. And, and then when it eats it from a carcass, it doesn't have to pin it down with its claw. So the comparison is, a lion is a suffix if it'll do that. So a kohen Am Haaretz is also a suffix. Maybe he will eat his truma with purity. Maybe he will eat it betuma, and therefore you have to avoid it. But I just have to mention an interesting thing. The implication of this statement is, it's very, very odd, that giving it to an Am Haaretz is just as bad as giving it to a lion, implying, of course, that you certainly would never give truma to a lion. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what we do with truma today. What do we do with truma today? This is an interesting point. Farmers have to separate truma from their grains, from their fruits, from their vegetables. Now we have a big problem. Today there is no kohen that is permitted to eat the truma, because every kohen is tameh, and we don't have the ashes of the paraduma to purify us. Moreover, even if you found a kohen who never became tameh, the truma became tameh by the people handling the grain. And a kohen cannot eat tameh truma either. So what do you do? Think about truma is not so bad really, because I'll tell you why. How much truma do you have to separate from a crop? A truma would be given to the kohen.
150.
So here's the thing. The oraisa, you can separate one grain, and that would cover a gigantic crop. Nidrabanan, you're supposed to separate at least 1/60th. And if you're average, you do 1/50th. And if you're generous, you do 1/40th. So let's say 1/50th is average. So, doraisa chita achas. Nidrabanan 1/50th, but it's brought down that where the truma is tameya and nobody could eat it, you go back to the doraisa. So, practically today, therefore, the amount of truma that is separated from a crop is just the chita achas. It's really not so much. But, right, so whatever it is. So theoretically, you could have a half a cup of wheat seed, and that could cover, you know, a thousand fields. But where you do get significant quantities is maser, because in addition to truma, maser has to be separated. And every year of the Shemitah cycle, except for Shemitah, Shemitah produce does not have trumas and misers. But every year, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, at least 10% has to be separated that in theory would be given to Levium. But once again, we don't give it to the Levium. We separate it, but we don't give it to the Levium. But that is 10% of a crop that only a Levi can eat, and if you're Tamei, the Levi doesn't eat that either. So what do we do with our trumos, and what do we do with our masros? So it's brought down this way. It's brought down that since there's no Kohen or Levi that could eat it today, we can feed it to the animals of a Kohen or a Levi. Because although that which could be eaten by a person, you cannot feed to an animal of a Kohen, but if the Israel cannot eat, I'm sorry, if a Kohen cannot eat the truma, you can feed it to the animal of the Kohen. So, what the way it works is that all of the animals in the Jerusalem are sold, just like chametz, they are sold to a Kohen. And since every Kohen is also a Levi, every Kohen is a Levi, so we feed all the Trumas and Masros of Eretz Yisrael are delivered to the zoo, and are fed to the various animals in the zoo. So it's interesting what the Gemara says, you certainly can't do. Anyone who gives truma to an Amaretz, you give to a lion. We actually do give our truma to a lion, among other animals, because that's the only way we could get rid of it. Now, if you had to take truma off in your own, let's say you bought produce that didn't have hashkacha, and of course in Eretz Yisrael, this is a bigger problem than outside of Eretz Yisrael. In Chutz La'aretz, I can walk into a grocery store and I can buy an apple or an orange or a peach and I don't have a problem. I don't need supervision. Although even then, there might be dyes or waxes. That's why you need to wash off the fruit, not only because of hygiene, but because there may be non-kosher. You know, fruits are colored with all sorts of stuff because merchants want fruits to look bright and red, right? Apples have to look real red, but part of the way they look red is because they're covered with shellac. Now, shellac, which is actually a paint ingredient, it comes from a beetle. It's actually a non-kosher food additive. But it comes up with water, so you just wash it up with water. But in Eretz Yisrael, you cannot buy a fruit or a vegetable without a hashgacha because of trumas and masros. But if you did, you would just separate trumas and masros yourself. So when you separate them off and you follow the nusach, what you do is, if you don't have an animal of a kohen to give it to, you double wrap it in plastic and you throw it away. It's kadosh, so you can't just throw it in the garbage, but if you double wrap it, you just you can throw it away that way.
When you're feeding the truma and masa to the animals, is it mostly to mix the truma and the masa together?
Yes. And the reason is because we treat every kohen as also a levi, so therefore the animals belonging to the Kohen are also an animal that belongs to a Levi, and therefore you can feed the Truma and the Miser.
Is this what they do with animals today also? Is there Maser Behema?
No, there is no Maser. No. Maser Behema we don't have today, because Maser Behema is only when there's a Beis HaMikdash. When there's no Beis HaMikdash, there is no Maser Behema.
Where?
Huh?
And
firstborn?
Yeah.
There is halacha of Bechor, but we circumvent that, because you're with a Bechor, you're in big trouble. Let me just go over this a second. The firstborn animal of a kosher animal is a korban. And if it's a korban, what do you do with a korban today? There's nothing you can do with it. And you'd have to wait until it gets a blemish, and then the kohen, then it could be shechted as a regular animal. But you're not allowed to make a blemish, so you know, you're really stuck. So what we do today is, when an animal gets pregnant with its first child, we sell a portion of that animal to a non-Jew, the ear, the lobe of the ear. So the animal, the mother of the Bechor, is owned partially by a Goy, and the halacha is that if there is a partnership between a goy and a Jew, the animal that's born does not have the holiness of a bechor. So it's very important. Every religious farmer will sell part of its pregnant animal, only the first time, because once it had the first child, you don't have to do it again. Well, you pick something that's relatively minor. You don't want the guy to come in and claim 50% of the meat or something. Because, you know, if it's a cow, there might be 300 pounds of meat there. So you don't want the guy to claim 150 pounds of beef. So you sell him something that's very, very small, a tiny little thing, and that's enough to pater the bechor. Now, if that didn't happen, and I know some cases where it didn't happen, where, you know, the person didn't think about it, you have a real, real problem, because essentially you have a live, because like having a radioactive animal, you have a live, you have a live korban in your flock. And that's very, very difficult, because you're not allowed to shear it. In the case of a sheep, that's very difficult, because if a sheep doesn't get shorn, just grows. I don't know how wild sheep do it exactly, but it just keeps on growing and growing and growing and growing. And you can't do anything with it. You can't work it, you can't milk it, you can't shear it. So it's a very, very difficult situation to be in. And this applies to what? This applies to a firstborn calf, a male calf, a firstborn sheep, which is a ram, a firstborn ram, and a firstborn goat. Now, it also applies to firstborn donkey, but there you have a bit of a simple race, which they still do today, because a donkey is not a korban. So the only thing you need to do if you had a firstborn male donkey is you redeem it with the sheep. But the sheep is not a korban. The sheep is a chulin animal that can then be shechted as a sheep. So still, to avoid, I don't know how many donkey farmers there are, they sell the donkeys here to a guy also. But sometimes they bedafka donkey because they want to do the mitzvah of redeeming the donkey. In fact, just a few weeks ago, I didn't go and see it, but they had invitations. Sometimes in Kikar Shabbat, they do a big deal. I don't know if you hear about that. They do a big deal about redeeming the donkey. Because it's a mitzvah that doesn't happen that often. And in fact, somebody asked Rabbi Yashiv about taking off Seder to see this great mitzvah of redeeming the donkey. Rabbi Yashiv thought the guy was absolutely nuts. But he says he wanted to take his yeshiva to see the ceremony. Okay.
No one chops it with an axe anymore.
No, that they don't do. That they don't do.
They do it
in Kikar Shabbat. Yeah.
So everyone brings a donkey.
Well, it's only one donkey. This is not a mass ceremony. One Hasidic guy or something will buy a pregnant female donkey that never had a child before. And he will not sell it to a guy, and he will have kavod. It's just like every 5 years, like somebody does it, to do the mitzvah of redeeming the donkey. And now the reason why that can be done is because, remember, the sheep is not a korban. That's the difference. A firstborn sheep is a korban. And then you're in big trouble. You can't do anything with the korban. There's no basis in it. But the sheep which redeems the donkey is not a korban. It's an animal that can then be shechted or sold or whatever it would be. So that's why that mitzvah is doable in a way that the mitzvah of the firstborn sheep is not. Okay? Yeah. Now, keep in mind as well, I'm going to go over this a little bit, it's good Torah knowledge for you to have. Again, the agricultural cycle in Eretz Yisrael is a 7-year cycle. Everybody knows. 6 years. And, of course, this coming year is a Shemitah year. Now, every year of the 6 years, the crops have to have truma taken off, which, since we don't have a Kohen that can eat it, even one grain per field is enough. Every one of the 6 years, there's 10% that theoretically should go to a Levi. But once again, we feed that to the animal that belongs to the Levi and the Kohen. Now, that's every year. From that 10% that goes to a Levi, another 10% is taken off, which is given to a Kohen. That's called Truma from the Miser. So there's Truma, and there's Truma from the Miser. Okay? Okay. So that's every year. Now, there is a second tithe, a second 10% that is also taken every year, but what it is depends on the year. In year 1, year 2, Year 4, year 5, that second tithe is called Maser Sheni. And what would be done with Man HaMikdash is, I would take that 10%, and I and my family would go to Yerushalayim, the old city, and we would eat that Maser Sheni in Yerushalayim. And if I lived very far away, I would redeem it on money, so the fruits can be eaten where they are, and I would use the money to buy fruits and vegetables and things to eat in the in Yerushalayim. That's called Maser Sheni. Now today we have that same dilemma. We cannot eat the Maser Sheni because we're not Tohar. So what we do today is we just redeem it on a coin that we set aside. And eventually, you know, the coin will be used when the Beis HaMikdash is built, but we just redeem it on a special Maser Sheni coin. Now that's year 1, 2, 4, and 5. Year 3 and year 6, there is a second tithe, but instead of being taken to Yerushalayim, it is distributed to the poor. And that's called Maser Ani. And that is separated today, and that's given to the poor, because you don't have to be taller for that. That can be eaten by anyone that's poor. So in addition, don't confuse this. In addition to giving 10% of my income to tzedakah, on year 3 and 6, I would give 10% of my crop to the poor. Now, we then come to Shemitah, the 7th year. Shemitah doesn't have any trumos and masros at all. Whatever grows, number one, on Shemitah, you're not allowed to plant or the like. So Shemitah, the only things you could eat are things that grow wild, or things that you planted before Shemitah that grew on Shemitah. But anything that grows wild during Shemitah is hefker. Anybody can come in and take it. So there's no chiyuv of truma because it's totally ownerless and hefker. So there is no tithing at all on Shemitah. And then after Shemitah, you're back to year one again, and we go back to the Maaser Sheni, right? So as difficult as Shemitah is, one of the leniencies you have is that you don't have to worry about the trumos and the masros during the year of Shemitah, and that's equally true today.
Once someone's claimed the hefka fruits or whatever during Shemitah, wouldn't there then be a fear of trumos and masros?
No, because the rule that hefker things are exempt from Shemitah, meaning anything that was hefker is exempt from truma and masros, even when you're kone it from hefker, and now it becomes yours. Right? There's once hefker, there is no din of trumos and masros. That's why there's an interesting shaila. You know, you may have heard of the one of the controversial issues of Shemitah, and I'm talking about Shemitah today, and this is a halachic discussion that's been going on for more than 100 years, is the so-called Heter Mechira. What's the Heter Mechira? Rav Kook, who was the first chief rabbi of Palestine, who was before the State of Israel, around World War I, saw the agricultural community in Eretz Israel that there was mass starvation. The people were dropping dead, literally. There was no bread. And Shemitah was coming, and they wouldn't be able to farm. People were dying of starvation when they were farming. And if they wouldn't farm for a whole year, what would happen to them? So Rav Kook developed a very detailed heter that, just like by chametz, if we sell the land to the non-Jew, I'm sorry, not the land, if we sell our bread to the non-Jew, then there's no issur of owning chametz because the non-Jew owns it. So Rav Kook developed a heter that we can sell the land of Eretz Yisrael to a non-Jew, and that would permit cultivation of the land during Shemitah, because land owned by a non-Jew does not have the holiness of Shemitah. Okay? And ever since then, going back from the 1920s, the chief rabbinate has relied on this Heter Mechira. So the rabbinate goes over to all sorts of non-religious farmers, for example, some religious as well, and they agree to sell the land to the non-Jew, and then they continue to work the land. This is called the Heter Mechira, and it's based on the idea that ownership of the non-Jew is not subject to the Shemitah laws. Now, most Haredi people do not accept the legitimacy of the Heter Mechira for a lot of reasons. So one argument is that even if you sell it to a non-Jew, it still has holiness. Another argument is that there's an issur in the Torah to sell Eretz Yisrael to a non-Jew. You're not allowed to do it. It's a sin. I mean, if I have a dira, I'm not allowed to sell my dira to a non-Jew. That's an avera in the Torah, in Eretz Yisrael. Chutz L'Eretz, I could. Right? So if you sell to an Arab, you know, you are over in the Shirvi Oraisa. Now, if you rent to an Arab, although it's not a great idea, that is halachically permitted, but it's forbidden to sell lands in Israel. So be it as it may, the Hetra Mechira is a very controversial idea, and still, things under regular Rabbanut supervision during Shemitah rely on the Hetra Mechira, and the Mahadran Hashgachos, including the Rabbanut's Mahadran Hashgachos, do not rely on the Hetra Mechira. They will use imported food from outside of Israel. Or some of it is Arab food, which is actually a very interesting issue. People have to realize that when you pay money to Mahadran Hashgachas, not to rely on the Hetra Mechira, some of your money might be going to Arab terrorists who might be using it to buy bombs or whatever. I mean, it's a very interesting issue that so if you're too religious to rely on the Hetra Mechira, you might be doing something really bad instead. But okay, but be it as it may, I just want to point out that people don't always realize that the Hetra Mechira has a downside in this way. That is, since the Hetra Mechira is assuming that the produce is not subject to the laws of Shemitah, when you buy it, you would have to take off Trumas and Masras. See, okay. Because it's only the stuff that is subject to the laws of Shemitah that is exempt to Trumas and Masras. And if you take the position that the Hetra Mechira is not subject, so paradoxically, the Haredim who don't recognize the Hetra Mechira will treat it like Shemitah stuff, and they will not have to take off Trumas and Masras. Right? But like the Rabbanut, they would have to take off Trumas and Masras from a lot of those situations. Okay, so that's just a little bit of a summary of the agricultural principles here. Okay, all right. So let's just do one thing. So now we're going back to the main topic, and the main topic is what is our source of Techiyas HaMesim in our Torah. So far all we had is Rav Yochanan, and Rav Yochanan said, "You shall give your truma to Aaron and his children." So Aaron was not never entered Israel. The answer is Techiyas HaMesim. Now we have a second source. Tanya Rav Simai Omer. Rav Simai says, Minayin l'tchiyas ha-mesim in ha-Torah. How do I know tchiyas ha-mesim is in the Torah? Shenemar, when Hashem came to Moshe before Yetzias Mitzrayim, Hashem said, V'gam ha-kimosi es brisi itam l'seis lahem es eretz kanan. God says to Moshe, ha-kimosi es brisi, I have made my covenant with them. Them meaning the Jews in Egypt, laseis lahem, to give them the land of Canaan. Now we have a problem. Hashem never lies. What do you mean to give them the land of Canaan? The them who lived in Egypt, they all died in the desert, except for Yeshua and Kaleb. So in what way can it be said that I'm sorry. I'm making a different point because this is actually going back in Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. I'm sorry. It's even going more. In other words, Hashem said, let me go back. It says, I appeared to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov with the name Kel Shakai, but they never saw my name Hashem. And Rashi explains, they never saw the Rachamim because they did not see my promises fulfilled. But I am fulfilling my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan. So who's the them? The antecedent of them is Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Hashem says, I am making a covenant to give Eretz Canaan to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are not alive anymore. The answer is, Techiyas HaMesim, they're going to come back. Lachem lo nemar, to you who are living now, that's not what it says. Lahem, to the Avos, Mikan, Techiyas HaMesim, Minato. Okay, so that's limit number two. So far, We have two drushas. We have Rav Yochanan, and we have Rabbi Simai. Now we go further. Shalu Tzedukim is Rabban Gamliel. Okay, who are the Tzedukim? Okay, the Tzedukim were a sect of Jews, and their founder was a man called Tzedok. And Tzedok basically denied the idea of the oral law, Torah Shebaal Peh, and as a result, the Tzedukim became a party during the Bayis Sheni that was not Mamin in Torah Shebaal Peh. Now, in truth, it was much more of a political party than a religious party. It's not the pshat that they had a religious hashkaf. It was the other way around. They thought that to further their political and social aims, they thought it would be better not to have all of this rabbinic theology. So real, in fact, the Tzedukim tended to be a very wealthy people. Many of the wealthy landowners in Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael, were Tzedukim. So the Gemara gives us very, by the way, don't confuse this with the Karaim. The philosophies are very much the same, but the Karaim are much later. The Tzedukim lived during the Second Temple period, and by the time of the Mishnah were extinct. There were no Tzedukim by the time of the Mishnah. The Karaim is post the Chasima of the Gemara, around the year 1000, in the time of Rav Sadia Gaon. And that also was a political thing, where there was a man who wanted Rav Sadia Gaon's position as the head of the yeshiva of Sura. He didn't get it, so he started a new belief system. It's funny, he started a new religion because he didn't like the position you got in the old religion. And therefore he developed the idea of Karaim. Karaim means Mikra, biblical people, people who don't follow the Torah Shemot penance. He basically said that he denied the binding authority of the Gemara. But here, the Tzedukim master up in Gamliel, Minayin shall Kadosh Baruch Hu mechaye mesim. How do you know that Hashem resurrects the dead? Where does the Torah say it? Amar lahem, Rabbi Gamliel says, I'll give you three proofs. Min haTorah, I'll give you a proof from the Torah. Min haNeviim, from the prophets. Min haKsuvim, from the writings. Three proofs. V'lo kiblu mimenu. The Tzedukim did not accept these proofs. Now, what are the three proofs? So this is yet another proof. Min haTorah. What is Rabban Gamliel's proof from the Torah? D'chsiv, as it's written at the end of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Hincha shochev im avosecha v'kav. Okay, so this is interesting. This requires a certain creative reading. In the Chumash, it says the following. Hashem says to Moshe, behold, you are going to die with your forefathers. And then it says, V'kam ha'am hazeh v'zana. And this nation will get up after your death and turn to idolatry and avodah zarah. So if you read the Pasuk Kipshuto, V'kam is referring to V'kam ha'am hazeh. But Rabban Gamliel reads it in a different way. That V'kam is not connected to what comes afterwards, but V'kam is what's connected before. Hincha shochev, you're going to die, V'kam, and you're going to get up. But you see what he's doing. You have to understand that he is taking the pasuk out of its normal interpretation because he is connecting V'kam to Moshe. So that was his first thing. So that's why the Tzedukim didn't like it. Amrulei, the Tzedukim said, they seem to have a good taina. What do you mean, V'kam? V'kam is not going back on Moshe. Udilma, V'kam ha'amazeh v'zana. It's going on the next part of the phrase. The nation will get up and turn away. Okay, here. I mean, again, superficially, the Tzedukim seem to have the better of the argument, actually. Okay. But let's see. His second proof is from the Nevi'im, and in particular, it is the Navi Isaiah, the Navi Yeshayahu. D'chsiv, it says Beferish here. Now this really is Beferish. Yichyu Meisecha, your dead bodies shall come to life. Nevelasi, your carcasses, Yakuman, shall rise. Hokitsu Verananu Sheikh Neyafor. Wake up and sing. those of you that dwell in the dirt, bodies, Kital Oros Talecha. The dew, again, we always talk about the idea that it's a spiritual dew, that the way Hashem is going to revive the dead is by the dew. There'll be a dew that will come on the bodies and revive them. And this is based on this pasuk. Tal Oros Talecha. Your dew is the dew of light. So L'chaira, this is pretty beferish. This pasuk actually says there will be a resurrection of the dead. So what did the Tzdukim say about this? They said, well, maybe this is not a global phenomenon. It refers to a particular event in history. Udilma Mesim Shehichya Yecheska. Now Yecheskel was a Navi after Yeshayahu. Now do you remember, this is actually the Haftorah of Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. It's a very, very dramatic scene where Yecheskel the Navi, this is before the Churban Bayis Rishon, shortly before, is taken to a valley that is filled with bones, these bodies that have already disintegrated, and they're bones, dry bones. There's no flesh or muscle on them. And he prophesies over the dried bones. And the bones join together and they get skin and muscle. And those mason are revived. And what's the purpose of that nevuah? So the purpose of the nevuah is that Hashem is saying to Yecheskel that the Jewish people feel they're like dead, they're destroyed, they have no hope. And this is the great message, that even when hope is lost, Hashem will give the nation new life. So the Tzdukim simply argue, listen, we admit to that event because that event is recorded in the book of Yecheskel. So maybe when the Navi Yeshayo, 100 years earlier, talks about the dead coming to life, he's not referring to the Tchias HaMesim of everybody at the end of Mashiach's time. He's referring to that particular incident of the Mesum Shechi Yecheskel. And in terms of Tchias HaMesim as a global phenomenon, we don't have any proof. Right? That's what the Tzdukim said. Okay, now we doesn't say what Rabbi Gamliel said to that, but let's see. He first gives you the proofs. Minak Ksuvin. And finally, Rabbi Gamliel brought a proof from the Ksuvin. Dichsiv, and this is Shir HaShirim, one of the five Megillas. V'chikech ki yein hatov holech l'dodi l'mei sharim dovev sifsei yishenim. Yeah, so this is describing the, remember, Shir HaShirim is written as a description of a man and a woman that are deeply in love and they care about each other, and this is a mashal for Hashem's love for Am Yisrael. So the woman describes the following, Chikech, your palate, your mouth, Ki Yein HaTov is as sweet as the best wine, Holech L'Dodi, coming to my beloved, L'Mei Sharim, in an upright way. And it says, Dovev Sifsei Yeshenim. And this sweet wine causes the lips of those who are sleeping to move with delight. So it's describing an image. Sleeping are people in the grave. They're sleeping. They're not alive. And somehow this spiritual wine is going to cause them to move. So that's a remez of Tchias HaMesim. But the Tzdukim saying, well, maybe not. Maybe it only means their lips will move based on another teaching of Rav Yochanan, because Rav Yochanan taught that whenever you say over the halacha of a Talmid Chacham who's no longer alive, his lips move in the grave with pleasure. So when you say Rabbi Kiva Eger, or the Vilna Gaon, or Rabbi Yashiv, or Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and you say something in their name, it's like their lips smile in pleasure. So the Tzdukim say, it doesn't say the whole body will come back. It talks about the lips of the sleepers will move. So maybe that just means, it's interesting that the Tzdukim are quoting a rabbinic saying for support. I mean, this is Torah Shebal Peh. Hey, maybe it doesn't mean Tchias HaMesim. Maybe it just means Sifsosav Dovavos. Their lips move with delight in the grave when you say something to them. Right, So the Gemara, it's interesting, so the Gemara basically says Rabban Gamliel gave a proof from the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ksuvim, and the stukim had a shlagup, had a taina on each of those proofs, and it's interesting that we're not given an answer how Rabbi Gamliel responded. Right? So we're going to have to think about this. Did he have a teretz? Did he not have a teretz? You know, that's not at all going to be clear. And their tainas are not. Sometimes their tainas are obviously weak, but their tainas here are not bad.
Can we say that's not before Tchias HaMeisim? Meaning, they left some even before Tchias HaMeisim.
That might be so, but at a minimum, you don't have a proof. In other words, I'm not saying it's a kasha on Chazal, but that's not enough. Rabbi Gamliel is trying to bring a raya, so it's not a raya if it's going on something else. It's not a kasha. You're right, because it might be before, but it's not. It's certainly not a proof. Okay, so maybe we'll stop here. Anyway, wish you all a chag sameach.